This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this was last summer in Portland, Oregon. Following the murder of George Floyd, protesters took to the streets of Portland for more than 100 consecutive days. Then President Donald Trump deployed federal law enforcement to the city to protect the boarded-up Mark O. Hatfield Federal Courthouse, which, along with other federal buildings, suffered millions of dollars in damages. Night after night, officers fired tear gas on protesters. Demetria Hester saw it all.
I definitely think about the violence. I actually got shot with 15 rubber bullets last year and got arrested.
Demetria is a founder of the group Moms United for Black Lives, Fight for Our Lives Forever.
People were coming down here just for the popularity, just for the clout, just for to drop their cash apps and say they're filming when they're supposed to be protecting our lives and fighting for our lives. And they wasn't. They were doing it all for the publicity, because look at how many people was looking at Portland and what was going on.
At the height of the protests, hundreds of diverse Portlanders marched in the streets daily. Demetria says the COVID pandemic helped expose racial injustice across the nation and in Portland. It opened people's eyes, she says. But now that the pandemic restrictions are being lifted, Demetria sees attitudes shifting.
Now it's COVID relaxation and everybody act like, let's go back to normal. No, nobody wants to go back to normal. Normal for white people is okay, but for Black and Indigenous people, it's not okay.
Last year, national media, including this show, broadcast the sounds and images of the nightly unrest in Portland. Select scenes upon which you could imprint the narrative of your choice. And then the cameras and the microphones moved on, ignoring the less spectacular but more essential daily activism that Demetria says is still going on in Portland.
Over the winter, we had coat and clothing warm drives. We actually had a program where we delivered warm food, warm meals every weekend for the whole entire winter. I mean, we just have been providing so much mutual aid to our community because no one's doing it.
So what has changed for Portland over the past year? Well, for one thing, in June, the city council voted to cut $15 million from the city's police budget. Community activists like Demetria Hester wanted a $50 million cut.
We want to defund the police. We've been saying it the whole entire time. But Ted Wheeler, which is our mayor, has been giving money hand over to the police bureau. Right now, they're in non-compliance with the DOJ. So it's like, what has changed? It's gotten worse.
Debates over local policing, mostly peaceful protesters, confronting racial inequities in one of America's whitest cities, from massive federal overreach by the Trump administration to anarchists committed to undermining all forms of government. How do we best understand the complex story Portland has to tell? And what have we learned since last year's demonstration? What has the city learned about itself? And where does it go from here? So in a sense, today we're going back to Portland. And joining us from the Rose City is Sergio Olmos. He's a freelance journalist who covered the protests and their aftermath for many of those days, actually more than those 100 days. You can find his byline in the New York Times, in Oregon Public Broadcasting, Reuters, and elsewhere. Sergio, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, can you take us back a little bit to last summer and just remind us of some of the things that you saw in downtown Portland night after night?
Yeah. What we saw at the beginning when protests started happening was just thousands of people. It was unprecedented, right? So like 10,000 people would be marching and holding a bridge, you know, raising their fists in the air. And then we also saw police respond in a way they haven't really to kind of a popular uprising, and we saw beatings, and we saw tear gas, and just, you know, mass, you know, kind of like brutality on the streets.
And then that was amplified when the Trump administration did send federal law enforcement officers to Portland, right?
Yeah, I think the way to think about it is kind of in four distinct kind of phases. The first is popular uprising with peaceful marches, and then nightly kind of direct actions, kind of more aggressive confrontations with police. And then there's the Fed War, what we call, where federal agents were sent here by the Trump administration. And that's that second phase where you have unmarked federal agents in military fatigues, sometimes snatching protesters in rental vans and tear gassing entire city blocks.
And night after night, as I said, because that's really, those are the images that the nation saw. How long did it take for all that to sort of subside? How long did protests go on, in other words?
Yeah, you know, that first phase where it's popular upright, it's popular protests and just massive amount of people, you know, that lasted weeks. And, you know, the feds didn't come in until around day 50. On July 16th, they arrested this man off the street named Mark Pettibone, and they put him into an unmarked rental van. And that just reinvigorated the protests. And you saw thousands of people come out, some of whom hadn't come out, you know, during the first George Floyd kind of uprising. And they had come out because of what the Trump administration was doing. And that Fed War, you know, where federal agents are tear gassing downtown Portland, that lasted 13 days, right? Like 2 weeks of that, where it's night after night of tear gas. And then even when those federal agents pulled out on like day 63, you know, there's still 37 more days of nightly protests, consecutive protests until day 100. And then even after day 100, you know, there's still the aftermath of the protests and scattered protests. And that changed, that influenced a lot of where we are today.
So that's what we're going to talk about for the rest of this hour. But I just want to reiterate, like, there's no one narrative about what happened in Portland, right? I mean, there's the federal overreach that you just described, the sort of taking people off the street in unmarked vans. And we really focused on the Trump administration's response in our coverage last year. And folks, if you want to hear that show, you should go to onpointradio.org and take a listen to our coverage from last year. But then there's also the various different kinds of protest groups, which we'll talk about, plus the complications of the Portland Police Bureau itself. And as Demetria Hester mentioned, the findings by the Department of Justice regarding basically bad policing on behalf of the Portland or by the Portland Police Bureau. So there's so much going on here, Sergio. I mean, how do we best understand where Portland stands today or sort of what the impact of this past year has been on the city?
Yeah, you know, like you mentioned, you know, focusing on that Fed War, you know, that's actually a small sliver of the 100 days, right? It's just 13 days. And I think the way to understand this 100 days of protests is anywhere, you know, in any city of America, that would have a legacy. You know, it's unprecedented here to have that kind of sustained, you know, massive protest movement. And so, like, what we have coming out of that is, like, in some ways, like, you know, George Floyd's brother thanked the city of Portland, right? But in some ways, the city has become a bit more conservative. Like, the mayor is asking for more police now, right? Rather than asking for defunding, he's asking for more police. And after the Chauvin trial, you know, there wasn't a huge amount of people on the streets, right? And this is Portland. It's a very liberal city. This is one of the cities where you'd think there'd be a huge, you know, number of people just kind of celebrating that. And there wasn't. And all of that is a legacy of the protests. There's a lot of people who just associate the word protest right now with kind of a broken window and just this toxic environment. And so in many ways, it's had like kind of a counteractive impact.
Okay, so you just mentioned Mayor Ted Wheeler asking for more police. And as we talked about before, the Portland City Council did vote to cut $15 million out of the police budget, which was not the $50 million that activists wanted. But here is Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler in a press conference a little earlier this month talking about adding more resources to the Portland Police Bureau.
This particular moment, we do not have the adequate resources deployed on our streets in a proactive way. And so I will fight for additional resources for the police bureau. I will fight for more police officers, and I will fight for more tools and whatever other support the police bureau needs to be able to get its job done.
Sergio, why specifically is Mayor Wheeler asking for more police? I mean, is it in response to the increase in gun violence that the city has also seen over the past year, or at least over the past several months?
I think there's certainly been an increase in gun violence since the start of COVID. And even right before that, there was an increase in gun violence. There's been a historic homicide rate. And so, you know, and this is kind of this is something that other cities have experienced during COVID. But I think the reason Ted Wheeler can ask for more police and not have a kind of political backlash is that there isn't the appetite there was last year for defunding the police. You know, Ted Wheeler was out there talking to protesters saying, yeah, you know, let's defund, let's have that conversation. And now he's saying, you know, I'm fighting for more police officers. In a year, he's kind of gone the other direction. And there isn't, you know, he's not feeling the same pressure he was a year ago to defund. So, like, clearly the political climate in Portland has changed.
Isn't that is remarkable, because I mean, many people might, if they haven't been to Portland or had heard of it before, if they'd heard of it before the protests of last year, it was sort of with the, you know, the quirky Portland image that the city has had to the rest of the nation for a long time. And are you saying that isn't quite reality right now?
Yeah, you know, the Alt Weekly kind of described Willamette Week described it best here. They talked about how that image of Portland, this kind of utopia for 20 to 30 somethings coming here, you know, being a musician and working at a coffee shop, and that whole Portlandia image, that the protests tore all that down and revealed that actually Portland is not as, you know, progressive as it thinks it is, and that for people of color here, which, you know, this is the most, like, the big, like this is the whitest big city in America, right? And so it tore that image down of kind of this like utopia, yeah, and revealed it as more of kind of a white utopia.
Sergio, hold on for just a second. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are going back to the city of Portland, Oregon, a year after more than 100 days of protests really seized the city in the wake of the murder of George Floyd. I'm talking with freelance journalist Sergio Olmos, who was in the streets for that period of 100-plus days covering everything that was happening in Portland. He joins us from Portland. And Sergio, just before the break, I'm sorry, I had to cut you off there so that we could take the break. You were talking about how last year really transformed or revealed that Portland wasn't necessarily the city of Portlandia, this quirky utopia, but rather a white utopia. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think for the people of color that came out during these protests, and for what it revealed about the city was that, you know, that this whole kind of progressive attitude it had was kind of a mirage, that actually the city was not nearly as progressive as it thought it was. And certainly some other cities during the George Floyd uprising, you know, cut their police budgets by more, like the city of Austin cut their police budget by more than Portland did, right? And it didn't have 100 days of protest. It just kind of got it done very quickly. And so for the people of color in the city, which again are a huge minority, I mean, this is an overwhelmingly white city. I think it revealed that, hey, that kind of quirky kind of 20 to 30 something kind of hipster attitude is really something that white people are enjoying, not the rest of kind of the people of color here.
Now, before in the first part of the show, we heard a little from Demetria Hester, and I was wondering what you heard in her story. I mean, just to remind folks, Demetria is a founder of the group Moms United for Black Lives, Fight for Our Lives Forever. Did you see her in the streets protesting last year, Sergio?
Yeah, like every day. Yeah.
And so what did you hear in her story in terms of her frustration that now that COVID restrictions are being relaxed, she sees people in Portland, her fellow Portlanders, wanting to, quote, go back to normal, but that people of color in the city, it's not okay to go back to normal.
Yeah, and, you know, Demetria has been critical of how protests kind of changed after Fed War in that kind of 37 days to the day 100, and even afterwards. You know, she was really kind of criticizing the kind of anarchist turn it took. And there are, there's a vibrant anarchist community here in Portland, but, you know, Demetria Hester was kind of like, hey, look, this is about Black lives, not about kind of, not an anti-state protest. And it took a more anti-state protest in the later days. And so, you know, what she's saying now is kind of that, you know, the focus on Black lives, you know, I think is her argument, has been derailed by this kind of, you know, anti-state kind of police fixation. And so, you know, now, you know, when I said the city's become a bit more conservative as a kind of reaction, you know, like I said, there wasn't a lot of people out after the Chauvin trial. Like, I think Demetria's pointing out that it is a little bit harder for Black activists to get kind of people in the streets because there is that bad taste in people's mouth of smashing windows and, you know, tear gas and stuff like that.
Okay, so this is the perfect opportunity for us to talk more and learn from you, Sergio, about exactly sort of the different kinds of protest groups that were in the streets of Portland last year, because, again, in the media, we just sort of lump them all together and say protesters, but there were very different groups with very different goals last year in downtown Portland. And so, I mean, folks will recall that then President Trump called the protests, quote, violent left-wing civil unrest. So what we did is we spoke to someone who is deeply familiar with the origins of the anti-fascist movement in Portland.
So I was an anti-racist skinhead. I was a founding member of a crew called the Minneapolis Baldies.
That's Mike Crenshaw. In the late 80s and early 90s, Crenshaw formed an anti-racist, multi-ethnic group which spread to the city of Portland, where he now lives. Mike told us how the punk skinhead culture that he took part in Minneapolis gave rise to Antifa.
We started in about 1986 with roughly seven guys and eventually expanded to a hardcore group of about 33 people. But our extended network had hundreds of people in it. From that local network in Minneapolis, we spread to St. Paul and eventually to other cities in the Midwest. And that network of people who were in solidarity with us, who weren't necessarily skinheads, was the beginning of what was called ARA, Anti-Racist Action. We were young adolescents coming into adulthood, developing our own political consciousness and starting to see that the root causes of different systems of oppression were linked. Our motto was, we go where they go. No safe haven, no safe space for Nazis. We didn't want them feeling safe coming to shows. We didn't want them feeling safe being an intimidating presence and harassing people in the community. And so we had to confront their presence with violence because we felt that that was the only way that they would go away. One thing that's clear with white supremacists is that they're committed to violence, that they're committed to racial terror and brutality as a means of maintaining white supremacy, whether it's through the police force in the armed forces and the lynch mobs, or just through random acts of violence. We understood that that was one of the most powerful tools that they have in their belt. And so we didn't believe that it would be appropriate if we were going to organize as an opposing force that we would just do speeches or leafleting. We did all that, but we also knew that we had to engage them physically. Many of us trained martial arts. We often carried weapons for protection. One could say that for a while shows were safer because there were less of them, or if they were there, they were there incognito and they didn't feel as comfortable doing their Roman salutes and wearing their insignias. But I do think that white power groups like Volksfront and the Vinlander Social Club, them moving their presence to an online digital platform is a direct result of the pressure that we put on them. By the time I moved to Portland, I was looking at different ways of interacting in the community through art and education, as opposed to trying to fight these guys when I could see that violence might make them leave the immediate vicinity, but it won't make them stop. It doesn't make white supremacy end. Portland's going to have to and is dealing with the questions around what is sustainable, what's worth sustaining, what needs to evolve and change and grow, and the diversity of means through which we create a culture of anti-fascism and anti-racism and anti-oppression. And I think one of the things that some of us arrive at is what it means to be anti-something, and then, well, what are you for? How do we create something that's not always in reaction? Protest culture is one thing, but it's one aspect of revolutionary movement. Discussing abolition in mainstream media platforms is amazing. And I think that that's a response of not just the white radical left, but of the broad base of youth of color who have been pushing the line and becoming more radical, more present. And on the local level specifically, we could look at the mayor ordering the police to no longer do routine traffic stops unless it's a life-threatening issue. And that's because we've been in the streets. That's because the movement has created enough support and awareness around this message, you know, that the police need to leave us alone and stop killing us and harassing us, that, you know, that's a good thing.
Activist, hip-hop artist, and former anti-racist skinhead, Mike Crenshaw. Well, Sergio Olmos, Mike Crenshaw there gave us a bit of the history of how what's known as Antifa emerged in Portland. But can you describe to us sort of what was Antifa last year in the midst of the protests? Who were they and what were their aims, their goals? Were there different factions? Help us understand that.
Yeah, of course. You know, what Mike Crenshaw is describing is, of course, this long history in Portland of anti-fascist organizing. And certainly for years before 2020, you know, Proud Boys would come into the city and anti-fascists would organize and kind of, you know, block them or push them out of, you know, out of public spaces. So I think one thing that's helpful, though, is in 2020 that what we think of as kind of Antifa, if you think of people in like all black clothing, you know, that's a tactic that's called black block. You just wear all black so, you know, police can't identify you from one another. You know, a lot of people who wore that weren't necessarily going out there as anti-fascists, right? And even the most popular anti-fascist group here, Rose City Antifa, they didn't actually organize any marches in 2020. But that tactic was certainly used by a lot of people who were organizing direct actions. These are protests, you know, against the police, kind of confronting them, taking it to them rather than just marching around, you know, with your fists in the air. And there are people who are advocating for abolition of police. There are people who are advocating for, you know, against capitalism. And so there's a lot of different groups and they, you know, you might look at them and go, that's Antifa because they're wearing all black clothing. But, you know, they weren't necessarily out there to oppose Proud Boys they were out there maybe for kind of a larger kind of anti-capitalist or anarchist or police abolition, or even some of them just in solidarity with people who were marching for defunding police.
But help us understand, I mean, those more radical groups that you just described, the ones pushing for direct action, as you called it, the anti-capitalist groups. I mean, I was reading, for example, Luke Mogelson's report in The New Yorker, extensive report on the history of Antifa in Portland. And he described that many of those groups, I mean, they are basically anarchists, right? Their goal is to attack and undermine government. And is what role did they play in the protests? Is it bigger than what was represented in the media or smaller? Help us understand that.
Yeah, I'll try to answer it in two ways. The first is during the popular, that first phase of popular protests, like with 10,000 people, there was always two groups, one meeting at Revolution Hall, kind of in the east side of the city, with marching huge numbers of people, moms, children, everybody was in that crowd. And that was organized by Rose City Justice, a group that was pushing to defund the police, a group of black organizers. The other group was in downtown Portland, organizing in front of the Justice Center. And this is a smaller group that would, you know, this is the group that was, it would morph into, they would go from defund the police to abolish the police. And this is a smaller group that was made up of, you know, abolition, people who were advocating for abolition, anarchists, anti-capitalists, right? And, you know, they would wear black bloc to not be identified from police. And they would throw water bottles. They would eventually stop some of them through like Molotovs and rocks and stuff at police. That's that group.
And so how responsible were they for sort of the shape and the dynamics that the protests took on, and especially in downtown Portland?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Towards the end, they were totally in the driver's seat. At the beginning, they were a smaller group that, you know, because it was so small, we're talking maybe hundreds of people compared to 10,000, right? You know, taking a bridge a few streets over. They were not driving the narrative. But as the protests waned, they took a more and more prominent position in how protests went, especially because a lot of people stopped coming out, right? And they, you know, as police brutality kind of occurred night after night, that group got more and more radical. Some of it was, again, just feeding off what the police were giving them. And some of them was, you know, you have 80 days, you know, of sustained protests. By day 100, you know, someone's just going to be more radical than where they started. And so certainly that group was no longer asking for policy concessions. They didn't want to change policy. You know, you had a core group of about 100, 200 people who were just advocating for what they were advocating for, which is the abolition of the state, of the police, and they weren't trying to vote anymore.
I see. Well, we actually got a voicemail from an On Point listener in Spokane, Washington. This is Jake, who told us there needs to be, he believes, much more attention and stronger condemnation of the very groups that you're talking about, Sergio. So here's Jake.
We know much of what happened has to do with the ongoing threat of Antifa, and it seems like you're hesitant to even use that word these days. I don't understand the unwillingness of the left to condemn these things. They intimidated, and we know what they did to Ted Wheeler, and the people who are the leftist and most giving them the longest leash, you know, and it took them forever to condemn these ongoing tactics.
That's Jake from Spokane, Washington. And Sergio, do you want to respond to that? I mean, did it take forever for the condemnation to occur?
I don't think it took forever for a condemnation to occur. I think there's condemnation going on throughout the entire time. I think what was happening that he might be interpreting as kind of a slow reaction was that, you know, there might have been people throwing water bottles. But the police response was so overwhelming, especially at first, and then with the feds, you know, tear gassing the entire city blocks, people being beaten, that I think people were looking at that and going, okay, on balance, do I care about the three people throwing rocks at police, or do I care about an entire police force kind of batoning, you know, groups of people? Mm-hmm. And I think people were just going, hey, look, this, we need to deal with this police force first, but I'm not going to worry about these three or four people throwing rocks. I think that's one way to look at it, is that there was a kind of focus on what the police and the systems were doing instead of just kind of three or four people throwing, you know, maybe even throwing a Molotov.
Yeah, but a couple quick things, though, that I think it wasn't all that long ago that federal authorities said, though, that the protests did cause more than $2 million in damages to federal buildings downtown. Is that right?
Definitely. And there was a lot of vandalism, a lot of spray paint, a lot of broken windows, definitely a lot of property destruction.
Okay, so then bring us back to the point you were making earlier. How much of how the protests ended up evolving, the direction it went in that you were describing, with the sort of the center being moved to the actions of these, you know, anti-capitalist groups that you describe, how much of that is what ended up having the effect of, like you said, a little earlier, making Portland a little more conservative, in fact giving Mayor Ted Wheeler more room to even say that the city needs more police now? We've just got about 30 seconds before the next break.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, that last period is kind of the last memory in people's minds. So that has a big effect on today's kind of thinking. Even though there were 50 days, you know, of stuff that people cherished about those protests, it's that last period that people start thinking about.
Okay. Well, Sergio Olmos is a freelance journalist in Portland, Oregon, who covered the protests there across the 100-plus days. And we're talking this hour about the effect that it has had on Portland and lessons learned. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In our next series or episode in our series about Amazon, which is coming up later this week, I just want to give you a heads up. We're going to be talking about Amazon's workforce. 1.2 million people around the world. It's the second largest private employer in the United States. So if you have worked for Amazon or are currently working for the company, we want to know what your experience is like. What are the best and worst parts for working for a company that's changing so much about how we live? Tell us your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for our next episode in our series about Amazon, which is coming later this week. Today, we are talking about the city of Portland, Oregon, and specifically looking back on all the city has experienced over the past year following the 100 plus days of protest that gripped Portland last summer. I'm joined today by Sergio Olmos. He's a freelance journalist who covered all of those days of protests in the city. His byline has appeared in Oregon Public Broadcasting, The New York Times, Reuters, and many more. Well, let's listen to On Point listener Anthony, who called us from Portland. He told us he took part in the protest last year.
We talk about Portland as having such violent crime. And the truth is like people are desperate. And it makes so much sense to me as a neighbor in this city, understanding why people are in such desperation. The city continues to lack the will to create resources that actually serve those in need.
He also said, Portland feels tired.
You know, it was frustrating being a pawn in Donald Trump's game, of course, last year. You asked why do you think this place is the center of it? And I think the truth is like there's a lot of white supremacy in the blood of this city and in the heart of it. And even though it's believed to be this liberal safe haven, we know that there's work to be done. And I think that that's true in all of America, is that we know that there is work to be done.
On Point listener there who called us from Portland. And I just want to make a note here that we did extend an invitation to Mayor Ted Wheeler and the Portland Police Bureau as well to join the conversation today. They declined, and we did not receive a response to our request from the Portland Police Association. So, Sergio, if you can just hang on here for just a second, I want to turn now to Elliot Young. He is a history professor at Lewis and Clark College and the Portland and on the Portland Committee for Community Engaged Policing. He's the co-chair there. Professor Young, welcome to you.
Hi, you could call me Elliot, and good to be with both of you.
Well, you know, so in the last segment, we talked about the various protest groups, you know, including Antifa and anarchist groups in Portland that played a role last summer. But let's focus on policing in Portland. Earlier in the show, we heard quick mention about the Department of Justice overseeing the Portland Police Bureau. Can you quickly tell us the story of that? What's going on that the DOJ felt like it had to keep tabs on policing in Portland?
So back in 2012, the Department of Justice came to the conclusion, because Portland police were killing people in mental health crisis and excessively using force, that the police here were using unconstitutional policing. So they eventually entered into a settlement agreement with the city. And this agreement is hundreds of pages long and mandates specific things that they must do. The focus of the agreement, however, is on training. It's on reporting. It's not at all on the outcomes. It's basically the assumption that if you do all of these reform measures, that this will somehow end up with a better, more humane, more just police system. And so the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing, PCEP, of which I am the co-chair, came out of that agreement. And it was signed in 2014. There was first a group called COAB that then fell apart, and PCEP emerged 3 years ago. I've been on it for 2 years. And our role in the settlement agreement is to be the bridge between the community and the city and the Portland Police Bureau. We were appointed by Mayor Wheeler, and we make recommendations to the police chief and to Mayor Wheeler.
Okay, so has the Portland Police Bureau then honored the terms of the settlement?
So up until up until a few months ago, the DOJ and the compliance officer came back and always said the city is basically in what they call substantial compliance and everything's fine. They had some critique, but everything was fine. They expected that after January 2020, or there was going to be a maintenance year, and then the settlement agreement was going to go away, the DOJ oversight was going to go away. And then what happened was the George Floyd racial justice protests hit, and the city basically, because the police were engaged in such overwhelming use of force and were not documenting it in their force reports, they stopped doing the training. So in the beginning of 2021, both the DOJ and this compliance officer said, no, the city is not complying with this agreement. They're out of compliance. And basically what has happened now is the DOJ is mandating particular remedies to the city. And if the city does not agree to it, it will go to mediation. And if the mediator does not resolve it, then it goes to a federal judge, Judge Simon. And in this case, Judge Simon actually has the power to dissolve the Portland Police Bureau, to take over the Portland Police Bureau. So, I think the city is showing signs that it is willing to accept the remedy suggested by the DOJ because they realize they don't have a choice. But potentially, we're in this strange position where the federal government is coming in as sort of, you know, the savior for to try to tame the Portland police, while at the same time, the city points out, which is true, it was the federal government which was doing some of the most egregious policing against Portland protests. So these are obviously different parts of the government, and so it's a complicated story. But the kind of remedies that the DOJ is proposing are not radical defund the police measures. They're calling for body cams. They're calling for training, things like that.
So lots of questions to ask you, Elliot. But first of all, just to be clear, there's nothing objectionable to the kinds of remedies that the federal government is calling for, because I mean those are remedies that other cities have sought to institute amongst their police forces. So just tell me a little bit more about why you don't think that that's satisfactory.
Well, you know, body cams, there's a lot of debate about whether body cams actually reduce use of force. There are some studies, one from DC, that suggests that it doesn't. There are people who critique body cams as saying this is just more investment in the police and in the carceral system, that it costs a lot of money. And PSEP passed a recommendation last year where we said we're not going to take a position on whether Portland police should have body cams, but if the city chooses to have body cams, that footage should be not held by the police. It should be held by a third party. The police officer should not be able to see the footage before they write their reports, because then they're just writing their reports tailored to what was captured on video, and that footage should be accessible to the public. So I think the city probably is going to adopt body cams because they don't have a choice. But I think if they do, they need to do it in a way that is not completely slanted towards the police. Mm-hmm. And of course, the police union is fighting this. But in this case, the feds trump the local and state laws. So I think the police union is not going to win.
Well, Sergio, can I turn back to you here for a second and just sort of get your take on policing now in Portland? Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, one thing that Elliot, you know, is coming to there is that the riot police, it's called the Rapid Response Team, they disbanded recently. So they got together in a meeting one night and decided they no longer wanted to do this, and they voluntarily disbanded. And so that group that was out there policing protests for 100 days, that group's gone, right? And that comes after the district attorney here filed charges against one police officer for his he batoned a protester to the face and filed charges against them. And so on top of all this going on with the DOJ compliance, right? And we should mention a report came out saying the Portland police used of force 6,000 times last year. It's right, historic use of force last year against protesters. The story kind of comes to the point now where the riot squad has just decided they don't want to do this and they disbanded.
Huh.
But it's important to remember that those people didn't go away. They just sort of got out of that or retired from that particular branch. So they're still on the police force. And it was very clearly a protest against holding one officer accountable. And one of the things that is clear is that the accountability systems that are in place are not working to discipline officers. And in November of 2020, after sort of these major protests, more than 80% of the voters voted for a new accountability system. So one thing I would sort of take issue with what Sergio said, and I agree with most of what he said, is I think there is still an appetite among most Portlanders for police reform, for holding the police accountable. I would agree, though, that the political leadership, particularly the mayor, has shifted and gone in the other direction.
So this is really helpful in understanding. So this ongoing years long issue with police brutality in Portland and the fact that the Department of Justice was already scrutinizing the city's police bureau before last year helps explain, in a sense, why the murder of George Floyd really touched off the initial surge of activism that we saw. But then, as you heard, Elliot, as you heard Sergio describe what happened over the course of the 100 days, that arc of the different phases of the protests, ending with, as he was describing, sort of anarchists but running the show a little bit there, especially in downtown around the federal buildings. You said that there's an appetite for police reform still in the city. Sergio also said, though, that there's similarly maybe it's made Portland more conservative. I'm looking at a quote here in the Oregonian from Mingus Maps, who's one of only two black members of the city council, who said, you know, specifically about all the property damage that was going on. He said, maybe the point of these protests is not actually real world reform. The point in many cases is literally the destruction that we wake up to every morning. Black liberation is not about broken windows. I mean, can you respond to that?
Well, you know, in every protest that's happened in the United States for racial justice, and we could even see internationally what's going on in Cuba now, protests for freedom, there are elements who will engage in property destruction, overturn police cars, et cetera. I just think it's a distraction to really focus on that when the bulk of the protests and even the Antifa protests are, if you listen to what they're saying, it is anti-state, it is anti-capitalist, but it's also about racial justice. So, you know, as Sergio was saying, like, I can't motivate a lot of passion about worrying about a Starbucks window being broken when the big issue is not only the years long, you know, few years long, this goes back decades in Portland of police, egregious use of force, racist policing. And, you know, as a historian, I think we have to think about the longer context. In the 1920s, the center of the Ku Klux Klan was Portland. So white supremacy has a long history. Some of the people who, like Teresa Rayford, who started Don't Shoot Portland, you know, she's been protesting this stuff for decades. Joanne Hardesty, a black city commissioner, for three decades has been protesting this stuff. So it's not, you know, it's not as if this just emerged because of the murder of George Floyd. But I think that what that did was all of a sudden that woke up a lot of white people and to join these protests. So I think one of the stories that is important about this is, although black Portlanders were leading this effort, the overwhelming number of people that I saw at the protests were not black, in fact, because we live in a city that is overwhelmingly white. And it's that alliance that I think is politically powerful,
right,
and is also seen as dangerous.
But we've just got barely a minute left here. I just want to ask you another quick thing, because Sergio beforehand said that following the Chauvin verdict, there wasn't anywhere near the amount of people coming into the streets in Portland, and that he sees that as, he saw that as evidence that there's been some cooling of support for protest in Portland. You don't see that?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah. One of the things is I thought, you know, after a few weeks, a month, like people just get tired. But what also happened is the policing increased, the dangers of going down and getting arrested increased. And, you know, I think as COVID also waned and people went back to work, people maybe directed their activism in other places. It's unrealistic to expect people are going to be on the streets for, you know, years and years at a time.
Well, Elliot Young, co-chair of the Portland Committee for Community Engaged Policing and a professor at Lewis and Clark College, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Sergio Olmos, freelance journalist who covered the 100-plus days of protests in Portland. Sergio, so great to have you. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Megan Chakrabarty. This is On Point.